If you'd like to follow along with our text this morning, have your Bibles open to Psalm 90. We're going to be looking in Psalm 90. As always, I'll be reading out of the New American Standard. Psalm 90. We all know it's the new year. It'll never be 2015 again. It'll never be yesterday again, for that matter. You'll never be as young as you are right now ever again. You don't get to go back in time. You don't get to relive the glory days. So with all of the positive things about it being a new year of new possibilities and new hopes and new dreams and making New Year's resolutions about all the things you're going to accomplish this year, each passing year is a reminder that you're also 1 year closer to death. Now, that's an awfully depressing way to start a sermon, isn't it? But I think it fits in with the tenor of Psalm 90. Let's begin reading a few verses here. Just in the first couple verses, O Lord, Thou hast been our dwelling place in all generations. Before the mountains were born, or Thou didst give birth to earth and the world, even from everlasting to everlasting, Thou art God. Compare that, though, to verse 3. Thou dost turn man back into dust. Go on here into verse 10. As for the days of our life, they contain 70 years, or if due to strength, 80. Yet their pride is but labor and sorrow, for soon it is gone, and we fly away. He says in verse 12, so teach us to number our days. And then he talks about the transitory nature of man's work in verse 17. Let the favor of the Lord our God be upon us, and do confirm for us the work of our hands. Yes, confirm the work of our hands. By way of introduction, one writer had this to say about Psalm 90. The sad and stately music of this great psalm befits the dirge of a world. Dirge being a term for a funeral song. How artificial and poor, beside its restrained emotion and majestic simplicity, do even the most deeply felt strains of other poets on the same theme sound. It preaches man's mortality in immortal words. And yet, even with all that it has to say about man's mortality, Psalm 90 offers us some solutions. Not that we get to live forever on planet Earth, not that our works on planet Earth are going to abide forever. But when we align ourselves with God and His work, there is a part of us, truly the substantial part of us, that will last forever. So verses 1 through 6 then have this to say. And again, verses 1 through 6. Lord, Thou hast been our dwelling place in all generations. Before the mountains were born, or Thou didst give birth to the earth and the world, even from everlasting to everlasting, Thou art God. Thou dost turn man back into dust, and dost say, return, O children of men. This harkens back, of course, to Genesis 3, verse 19. That there was a promise that was made all the way back at the beginning in the garden in chapter 2. There's a tree in the middle of that garden, the tree of the knowledge of good and evil. When you eat from that tree, you shall surely die, God says. Now, it was because of God's grace that they didn't die the very day they ate from the tree. But even with that being said, the day they ate from the tree, the process of physical death began. And there was a promise made to Abraham in chapter 3 that because of what you've done, because of the presence of sin in this world abiding as it is, there shall always be death on planet Earth. And you will die. From the dust I made you, and to the dust you shall return. Solomon echoes this in Ecclesiastes chapter 12 and verse 7. Notice what the writer of Ecclesiastes has to say here. Then the dust will return to the earth as it was, and the spirit will return to God who gave it. It's the same affirmation here as in Psalm 90. And we've all experienced it as well. Save for the extraordinary examples that we read about in the Bible, Enoch, for example, or the prophet Elijah ascending to heaven on a fiery chariot, or Jesus, the Son of God, returning to God in Acts chapter 1 on the cloud. But save for those extraordinary examples, we all have seen death, and we all will experience it, unless the Lord comes back in judgment before that time. But I like in verse 3, that ray of hope. Yes, we're going to return to the dust. Yes, we're all going to die, and yet there's a part of us that will abide that God is going to collect. Return, O children of men. Like Ecclesiastes 12:7 says, your body returns to the dust from where it came, but the spirit will return to God. A ray of hope there. Verse 4. For 1,000 years in thy sight are like yesterday when it passes by, or as a watch in the night. Now we're all familiar with what Peter had to say about this, that 1,000 years is like a day to you, O God, and a day is like 1,000 years. But look what the writer of the psalm has to say. Now, I'm not contradicting at all what Peter had to say, by the way, because when it comes to time, yes, a day is like 1,000 years, and 1,000 years is like a day. But the writer of the psalm says, for 1,000 years is like yesterday in thy sight when it passes by. You know what I love about God, among many, many other things that I love about God, is that time just doesn't fit anywhere in Him. The concept of time is a created concept by God. And because He's the creator of it, He stands outside of it. Because He's the creator of it, He's not accountable to it. That to God, He sees all things at once and together. That whether it's 1,000 years or a day or yesterday, the past, it's all the same to God. Time is irrelevant to a timeless and eternal God. Now, we have a hard time understanding that. We want to fit God into a box that's similar to us. We want to understand God in a way that we understand ourselves. And so sometimes because of that, we have a very limited understanding of God. Because we are temporal beings who see everything linearly, as in everything happens in a line or a sequence of events. There was yesterday, there's today, and there's tomorrow, and it follows that linear pattern. We want to see God in the same way. We can't understand God like that. God is outside of time. Time is a thing of this universe. God is eternal. He's not temporal like we are. And even though verse 4 is hard to understand, how 1,000 years can seem like yesterday as it passes by, that is simply the best that the psalmist can say with human language in terms of trying to understand God. Thou hast swept them away. Now other translations will say, thou hast swept men away. And I think that's a proper interpretation. Not that God has swept time away or those thousands of years or the yesterdays, though that is certainly true in a certain way. I think he's talking about people and the transitory nature of people. That thou hast swept men away, he says. Like a flood, they fall asleep. How many people have lived on planet Earth? So many millions? So many billions? One person that I listened to estimated that there could have been as much as 105 billion people who've lived on planet Earth. And that just boggles my mind. 105 billion people who have ever lived on planet Earth? And God has swept them away. In the morning, they're like grass which sprouts anew. So even with all of this sweeping away, even though man dies off like floods and recedes back into the ocean, he still sprouts up again. Destroy man as much as you want, but we sprout back up. And God has designed it that way, by the way. He's designed our lives to be relatively short. He's designed our lives to feel very fleeting. And yet the planet continues to be repopulated over and over and over again. Whether it's a worldwide flood in the Bible where only Noah and his family are saved, or it's the Black Plague from Europe, we still seem to repopulate. World War I and World War II
Mankind always bounces back. We always bounce back like grass which sprouts anew. And yet, even though we bounce back, it's not positive. In the morning it flourishes and sprouts anew. Toward evening it fades and withers away. So sure, we sprout back, and every person that dies is replaced by one or even two people. And yet it's still very short. So fleeting. Perhaps there are a few verses that you're familiar with in Isaiah 40 and verse 8. The grass withers and the flower fades. But who's the only thing that abides forever? God and His Word. Go to James chapter 4. And in James chapter 4, we see a similar description where he says, beginning in verse 13, "Come now, you who say, today or tomorrow we shall go to such and such a city and spend a year there and engage in business and make a profit. Yet you do not know what your life will be like tomorrow. You are just a vapor that appears for a little while and then vanishes away." Now, the hard part about this concept is that if you don't believe in God, and you don't believe in the spirit and the soul, and you don't believe that there is an eternal dwelling place for what is essentially, spiritually you, this is a very hard concept to come to grips with. And you do see the way unbelievers struggle with it. You do see the way that unbelievers struggle with it by always putting all of their stock in a legacy. I know I'm going to die. I know my time is limited, so I have to do everything I can to bolster my legacy so that people will remember me. We've been studying the pharaohs lately in our Bible class in the book of Exodus. One of the things about the pharaohs in the Egyptian understanding of eternity was that you were not welcomed into eternity. You didn't have an eternal dwelling place unless people on planet Earth remembered who you were. That's why the pharaohs built such extravagant tombs for themselves. That's why you see the pyramids of Khufu and Khafre. That's why you see inside of the tombs all of these messages and hieroglyphics, the stories of their lives. That's why you see monuments and statues. And that's why when your enemies really wanted to insult you after you died, they defaced all of your statues. And they removed your memory from the records of the people. Remember what Moses III did to his stepmother, Hatshepsut, defacing all of her statues and scraping her face off of walls. Because the ultimate punishment that you could inflict on your enemies was to remove their memory from the people alive. And people put a lot of stock in that. When I die, I want to have a bronze statue in Central Park. I want to have a wing of a hospital named after me. I want to have a foundation or a trust fund. I want a legacy. We struggle with that. We struggle as we get older also. We grasp onto youth. We pay exorbitant prices for cosmetic surgery, so that we always look the way that we did when we were in our prime. The thing about cosmetic surgery, though, is that more often than not, it does not have a long shelf life. This is what we do, though, when we don't have faith in God. Because life is pretty miserable without Him. Our sin and God's wrath explain life's brevity, though. Pick up in verse 7. He says, "For we have been consumed by thine anger, and by thy wrath we have been dismayed. Thou hast placed our iniquities before thee." The sense I get from verse 7 there, or verse 8, that thou hast placed our iniquities before thee, not before us, but before thee, is almost like the idea of evidence laid before an investigator. Where you might have a detective or an investigator who has all this evidence. He lays it out on a table. He numbers it and he organizes it and investigates the evidence. Our sin is laid before God as the evidence of our fallen character and our sinfulness. Our secret sins, he says in verse 8, in thy light have been shown in thy presence. Our secret sins. You know, that's a tough verse, isn't it, in practical terms? Because we can fool everybody else, and we can put on a tie and look nice on Sunday mornings, and we can mow the grass in our front yard and put on a facade so that we look the part of the happy, prosperous, spiritually minded American. You can fool everybody else, but you can't fool God. There is no facade, there is no mask that you can wear that can trick God, because your secret sins have been laid out before Him. He knows. He knows. Here's a practical application in your prayer. Be really careful about being kind of like generic with God. The temptation, and this is not a criticism, by the way, of people who've come forward, because I know it takes a lot of courage to come forward and confess a sin in front of the congregation. I understand that. But sometimes when we come forward, we veil it in very generic language where we say, well, I've just been struggling a lot lately. I've had a hard time lately. I'm just not feeling like a strong Christian. But we don't want to put an actual name to what our sin is. Instead of saying, I've been struggling a lot lately when you've been committing adultery, just admit that you've committed adultery. Call it what it is. But we kind of use these generic terms to skirt around the issue. You can't do that with God. You can't. If you're addicted to pornography, you can't just pray to God and say, God, I've just been struggling with a hidden demon lately. And God's going, don't talk like that to me. I know what you did. Don't skirt around it. Don't tiptoe around it with me. You might be able to do that with everybody else. You can't do that with God, though. He knows. He saw it. He witnessed it. He was there when you struggled with it. So avoid the temptation to be generic with God. Be specific and tell God. Because it's not like you're hiding anything from Him. You're not saving face with a God who knows everything. Verse 9. For all our days have declined in thine fury. We have finished our years like a scythe. As for the days of our life, they contain 70 years, or if due to strength, then 80 years. Yet their pride is but labor and sorrow, for soon it is gone, and we fly away. If you have a subtitle in your Bible for Psalm 90, who does the subtitle say wrote Psalm 90? Moses. And I have no reason, by the way, and neither do any of the commentaries that I read, I have no reason to believe that it wasn't Moses who wrote Psalm 90. Kind of put it in its context then, and think about what Moses was going through. In previous generations of his people, the Israelites, you saw people living to be 200 years old, then 180 years old, then 140 years old, and here's Moses now, and he's not going to reach that in his lifetime. He's not going to reach that. And Joshua doesn't reach that. Joshua lives to be 110. So what Moses has seen then, remember, Moses wrote Genesis as well. How hard would that be to write Genesis, to be inspired by the Spirit, to write Genesis and to go, and Adam lived 900 plus years, and Methuselah lived 900 plus years, and Noah lived this many years, and he lived this. And to go like, wait a minute, I see what's going on here. And you have no expectation of reaching that lofty number yourself. How hard would that be to know that because of the condition of planet Earth, that because of our fallen nature, and that you've seen now the years of human life dwindle to a very extreme degree, where only a few thousand years earlier people were living to be 900, and you're looking at yourself at 120 going, I'm not going to make it even a whole lot further than this. That must have been very hard for Moses. And then for him to predict now that not only are people going to live less than me personally at 100 plus years old, but people are actually going to live significantly less than that going forward. And even now, with all of our medical technology, with as great as hospitals are and doctors and nurses and everything that we have available to us, even now, verse 10 is still true. If we make it to 70 years, we count ourselves pretty fortunate. And everything after that is icing on the cake. You hit 80 years old, and that's only because you're strong and healthy. You might live to be 100, and there's very few people who do. And I just find it very interesting that so long ago, Moses wrote this, and it still stands true today. Yet their pride is but labor and sorrow. You might live to be 80. Hey, you might live to be 100 years old. And yet how many of those years were spent in labor and sorrow? How many of those years did you spend struggling to make ends meet? How many of those years did you spend arguing with people or holding grudges or having people hold grudges against you? How many of those years did you have to work a hard job? How many of those years did you have to say goodbye to friends and family who passed away? Did you have to bury one of your own children? Did you have to bury a spouse along the way? How many wars were you alive to witness? How many wars are you a veteran of? 70 or 80 years, if due to strength, and yet they're filled with such struggle, such labor and sorrow. So he says in verse 12, "So teach us to number our days, that we may present to thee a heart of wisdom." One thing I like about verse 12 is that this attitude is not something that you're born with. It is a learned attitude. So teach us to number our days. An awareness of your mortality does not come naturally then. That's the takeaway for me, is an awareness of your mortality does not come naturally to you. You have to be taught how to number your days. You have to sit here and read Psalm 90. And you have to read about the struggles of the Israelites. You have to read about the struggles of Elijah and Jeremiah, the prophet of sorrow and tears. And you have to read about John the Baptist and Jesus, the man of sorrows, and Isaiah 53. And you have to see your own family, your own life, your own body stricken, barely enduring. You have to learn to appreciate life, because appreciating life doesn't come naturally to any of us. That's why we do such dumb things. That's why we waste our days. That's why in a marriage we waste so much of our time arguing and stressing and being angry at each other. If you were smart enough to number your days, do you think you'd waste your days being mad at your spouse? You only get so many days with them, with the person that you love most in this world. How many of those days did you waste? You only get so many days with your kids before they're going to move on, and you're not going to see them as often or in the same way that you did when they lived at home. And yet we spend those days exasperated, tired of them, wishing, are they 18 yet? You only get so many of those days. Lord, teach us to number our days. Teach us to number our days, so that not only can we appreciate them while we're here, but so that we can have a heart of wisdom that looks forward to eternity, when there will no longer be goodbyes, and there will no longer be sorrow, and there will no longer be tears. Because if we can't have that attitude in this life, we probably won't make it to the next life to be with God in heaven. Let's read the last part of this psalm, beginning in verse 13. Do return, O Lord. How long will it be? Be sorry for thy servants. Satisfy us in the morning with thy loving kindness, that we may sing for joy and be glad all of our days. Make us glad according to the days thou hast afflicted us and the years we have seen evil. This reminds me a lot of 1 Peter chapter 1, which we don't have time to read, but I recommend in 1 Peter chapter 1, just start in verse 3 and read on through the end of the chapter. And that's the point that he's getting at in 1 Peter chapter 1. Is that this life is full of suffering. This life is full of suffering, but this isn't where our treasure is. And we must learn to trade out the perishable of this life for the imperishable of the next life. And it's because of our sufferings that we can learn that. Now, I know human nature is to avoid suffering at all costs. We don't want to feel pain.
We don't want to be in anguish. We don't want to suffer. That's human nature. And yet it is the suffering of this life that produces in us the gold for eternity. Make us glad, he says in verse 15, according to the days thou hast... What does he say? Make us glad according to the days that thou hast given us good times. Make us glad according to the days that we've had a party and revelries. Make us glad according to the days that we've had enough money in the bank to feel confident in the future. Make us glad according to the days that we've been young and healthy. No, he says, make us glad according to the days that thou hast afflicted us. Because it's in our affliction that we learn to appreciate you and look forward to eternity. He says in verse 16, let thy work appear to thy servants and thy majesty to thy children. Give us an ever-present awareness of you in our lives and the work that you're doing. And verse 17, and let the favor of the Lord our God be upon us. Do confirm for us the work of our hands. Yes, confirm the work of our hands. McLaren said in his commentary on the Psalms, this prayer expresses a deep longing, natural to all men, and which seems yet incompatible with the stern facts of mortality and decay. Speaking specifically of verse 17, McLaren says, we should all like to have our work exempted from the common lot. What pathetically futile attempts to secure this are pyramids and rock inscriptions and storied tombs and posthumous memoirs and rich men's wills. Why should any of us expect that the laws of our nature should be suspended for our benefit and our work made lasting while everything beside changes like the shadows of the clouds? Is there any way by which such exceptional permanence can be secured for our poor deeds? Yes, certainly. Let us commit them to God, praying this prayer, establish thou the work of our hands upon us. And what the writer goes on to say is, we do this when we make God's work our work. When you make God's work, your work will last for eternity. When you make His will, your desire to match up with His desire, that is the only escape from the transitoriness of this life. It is the only escape from the death and the decay that comes along with being a human being living on planet Earth for 70 or perhaps 80 years. Now, if you're not a Christian here this morning, you need to be. You need to put God first in your life by accepting that His Son, Jesus, came for your sins, to die for you, to die for me, to die for all of us. Mark 16, verse 16 says, he who believes and is baptized shall be saved. So whatever need you might have, I encourage you to please come forward as we stand and sing.